Throughout the year, we drink NC wine, cider, and mead. Whether you join us for an event, plan a visit to your local winery, cidery, or meadery, or enjoy a meal at your favorite restaurant perfectly paired with NC wine, anytime is a great time to get out and give love to your local maker. To plan your trip, download the NC Wine app or visit ncwine.org.
Hi, I'm Joe.
And I'm Matt. We're the NC Wine Guys. Welcome to Cork Talk.
In this episode, we sit down with Eric Matran and Eric Hurtado of Fireclay Cellars in Pittsboro, North Carolina.
Eric and Eric talk to us about how Fireclay Cellars got started, some of the struggles they deal with growing grapes, and how they embrace an assortment of winemaking styles to make the most of their climate. One note about this episode, we were recording in their tasting room during business hours, so you may hear a few customers from time to time.
Wine Class with the Wine Mouths is back. Join us as they continue through the journey in the next chapter of the history of wine.
This episode is made possible in part by a grant from the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council. You can find out more about the council by going to their website, ncwine.org.
So sit back, pour a glass, and listen. So we're here today with Eric and Eric at Fireclay Cellars in Siler City, North Carolina, for an episode of Cork Talk. Welcome to Cork Talk.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Happy to be here.
So we'll start with Eric number one. So introduce yourself, tell folks who you are, and what you do here at Fireclay.
All right. Well, my name is Eric. I do pretty much everything that needs to be done. I'm a pretty small family winery, so... from mowing the lawn, growing the grapes, making the wine, everything you can think of, sometimes doing the tasting bar, doing events, doing podcasts.
Put that on the resume.
Yeah, put that on the resume. It's always funny when people come here and you know, usually I'm outside with a full sun hoodie on and everything and come and just drink water and not wine because I'm so dehydrated. So it's usually when I, like, if you ever want to talk to me, I'm usually like, out in the vines. That's where I prefer to be.
That's where we ran into you today. We were driving in and you had that sun hoodie on.
Yeah,
like, oh, there's Eric.
There you go.
You got to if you're out there, though. Don't want to get sunburned.
Yeah.
And I'm Eric number two, also known as Other Eric. But I just assist with whatever needs to be done. I've been making wine for 6 years, wine, mead, and beer. It was a fun experience actually coming out to Fireclay when I was doing a Chapel Hill mead project. Met the family, quickly saw the vineyard and had to know who these people were. And first introduced to Andre, and he was like, oh, you need to meet my son, Eric. I was like, oh, funny. That's great. 2 years later, we ended up working together, but pretty much managing the cellar, doing wholesale, doing a little bit of tasting room and whatever I can do around the vineyard.
I remember first meeting you. My dad met you. He's like, I met this guy here today, and he makes mead, and he's going to come help harvest, you know, and I'm always so skeptical. It's like, you know, we, like, start at 6 a.m., and all of them are like, oh, this guy, you know, like, oh, he's, like, another, like, kind of like me, you know, but it was great. Like, I met you today, and I was like, oh, you know, I expected him to be, like, way older, and I was like, this is great, you work, it was awesome, it was perfect, like, it was beautiful, so.
A little 5'5" kid comes walking in.
Like, are you old enough to
It took a while to connect the dots, because I was like, you know, I don't know why I expected a mead maker to be, like, have a beard and old, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Those are the territory, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Oh, for sure. I love to bring in those stereotypes.
So how did Fireclay get started?
Oh, man. So I guess I'll try to make a long story slightly shorter, but my grandfather always made wine. And when my parents moved here maybe 40 years ago, they started growing grapes in their backyard. They grew muscadines. My grandfather eventually passed away. And so when I was 13 or 14, I started taking care of the muscadines in the backyard and like pruning them and everything like that. And then... when I finished college, I was like, I really love outdoors. I love taking care of like grapes. It was really fun. And I wanted to have a place where I could like, hey, My dad also grew up on a farm, so that helped. And we had a lot of farm equipment. And I was like, hey, we should have this, like, muscadine farm. Maybe we should sell, like, some fresh muscadines. And that was about the time when all these wineries were coming into play. I was like, oh, well, actually, there's, like, other wine in North Carolina. We can, like, make wine. We love wine. And so we started going around and visiting all these wineries. I remember you guys were starting to come around then. And that was awesome. So I was like, oh, you can make some really good wine in North Carolina. So we looked for land. And we did have the intentions of growing grapes here. So I tried to find, like, you know, I was out here digging holes with a shovel, and the realtors was like, what is this kid doing? I was digging holes. I was like, I got to make sure the drainage is good. Like, what's the soil like? You know, it was all on, like, a hill. And then we started growing. We started with, like, 2-3 acres, and then we sold grapes. And then we made grape wine over at Windsor Run. And then slowly built a place, and then started making wine here in 2018.
Very cool. So now, where did the name fire clay come from?
I named it after the soil, because it's like fire clay. I also joke because I name it after all the fire ants.
Nice.
And people used to do, like, they used to shoot shotguns out here, and so I used to every once in a while I'd find, like, a shotgun shell, so they, that's why I call it fire clay as well. That's still kind of a joke.
It hooks in on many levels, right?
Yeah, mostly the land and the soil. I wanted something that had something to do with, like, the vineyard, you know.
Seeing the fire ant red will come out and play.
Yeah, yeah, very true. I just have to convince my mom that fire ant's a good, you know, wine name.
It's a full name.
If you can pass the TTB as well.
So. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, good luck with that. Mom might be easier. She seems reasonable.
So. Yeah, she's pretty reasonable.
So what was the initial planting of grapes then?
Oh, wow. I actually planted some Chardonnay. These are the grapes. I'm going to name all the grapes I pulled up. All the grapes I pulled up. I pulled up Chardonnay. I pulled up Niagara. I pulled up Saval. I pulled up Merlot. And I pulled up, I had Syrah, and then I basically, Treminet and Chardonnay were the main whites that just did really well here over, like, a couple years, and I needed something that was more disease resistant for my style of farming. So those are the two main whites, and then the Cab Franc lasted a long time, the Tannat does really well here, Cab Sav. But now we have a whole bunch of other new varieties as well. I don't know if you want me to go into everything.
Yeah, sure.
Well, now that I named most of them, we grow Crimson Cabernet and Cabernet Doré. They're hybrids of Norton. So those are doing really well. And we planted the new Pearson's Disease, UC Davis Walker varieties this year, Passante Noir and Arante Noir. I'm pretty excited. Then we planted the Noir and Black Spanish this year as well. So always trying to, like, plan 5-10 years in advance. You know, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket, I guess.
Right. So talk a little bit more about those two, Cabernet Doré and Crimson Cabernet hybrids. Because a lot of people probably haven't heard of those or just starting to hear about those.
Yeah, they're hybrids of Norton, and they bring some resistance that a Norton brings. Like, Norton is, I guess, a native grape. We can get into, like, the genetics and the arguments about if it's actually native or not, but we don't need to, like, go down that rabbit hole. But it does thrive pretty well, and I was looking for something that was more Pearson's disease resistant. Norton is, it's more tolerant of it. I shouldn't say resistant, but just researching online, trying to find different grapes to grow, and I can't remember how I landed on those. And so Crimson Cabernet, last year was our first big vintage of it, and it has a lot of Cab Sav similarities with, like, a touch of Norton. I think it makes a great wine. It's definitely different in the grow, though, and the Doré is more similar to, like, a Sauvignon Blanc, and that's the white of it. And it's really good too. We have in the tank downstairs. I don't think you've tried it, have you?
No, I don't think so.
All right. So after this, we'll go down and we'll go down and try it. And I really like the wine. It's great. Yeah, they're both really good wines, but they definitely took a different farming approach in a way. Like, they are more tolerant, but they, the problems that they have, I don't have problems with the other ones. I cane prune everything. The way they're fruitful and the way they grow is slightly different. Like, it's harder to just spur prune them on BSP. You can't quite do that with that variety. You have to treat them like a Norton. Sometimes if you spur prune it to two buds, the first bud isn't going to be fruitful, so you got to leave a bunch of buds, and then if you do that, you're going to get spur creep. And so now I cane prune everything, and every once in a while, I'll make four canes sometimes, which is crazy.
It was insane. It was literally insane. It was a forest. But it's fun.
I have a picture, and they're like twice as tall as you.
Yeah. It's definitely over 10 feet. I'm just like, so you have to be a giant to work here at Fireclay. Okay, cool.
Sometimes, in the rain, we get so much growth sometimes.
So how many acres total is in your vine?
About 7.
Okay. That's a good number.
Yeah, it's enough. I mean, my dad always wants to plant more, and I'm like, nah.
We're good.
Yeah, we're good.
So talk to us about some of the wines then that you're making from these grapes and other things you're making in addition to wine.
All right. I'll let Eric talk about the other additions to just wine. How about we go into there?
First we'll start off. It's really fun. We started collaborating when I was working over at Honeysuckle. I really missed working in a vineyard and making wine, especially, you know, it was nice to really incorporate local honey, King Cobra Apiary based out of Saxwell Hall. And it was because of Arthur. Shout out to Arthur.
Yeah, Lord is Arthur.
I saw on his fantastic Instagram, like, you must check out this most beautiful winery located in the heart of Chatham County, Fireclay Cellars. And I was like, okay, one day I'll go out there. So eventually came out here, saw what was going on, talked to Eric, and we had this idea to make a Chamberson Nouveau mead. So came out, and that was, that must have been like 2019. Pretty much just came out, harvested, had such a great time, saw the quality of the fruit, which was just insane. And Eric's like, well, here's a case of wine and take like 100 pounds of grapes. So immediately went back to the meadery, dumped it in, and thus kind of created this amalgamation of incorporating grapes into meads. So when we started working together just over a year and a half ago, we started a small mead program with all King Cobra Apiary honey. Our first one was hibiscus herbal with lemon verbena, ginger root, elderflower, and hibiscus. And we started canning that, doing it on draft. Then we brought in a peach and green tea mead named after my cat Peaches. So it was nice to kind of bring those flavors in and bring taps essentially to Fireclay. From that, every year we've made a piquette so we can drink it, and then now we made enough that we can't drink the full supply, and we just recently released our skinny dip Traminette piquette with 2 days worth of skin contact, all in cans, and then we have our Chamberson piquette as well, Great Crush. Just something kind of like a vineyard juice in a way, of something you would drink outside whenever you need a little beverage, a little pick-me-up. We're constantly just evaluating what works in the cellar and what doesn't. We have a few unmarked kegs that are like a mixed culture Traminette, because you have a few too many and you have a sour beer and you're like, oh, what happens if we dump this in the keg and forget about it? 2 years later, we try it and we're like, oh, wow, this is what happens.
We still got that Pet Nat Piquette we made 1 year.
Piquette Nat?
Pet Nat. We forgot about it for years and then we're just like, we need to disgorge this. And so that's what we've been doing. And we're like, I will just leave it as it is. Like, no sulfites, no nothing. Just. But eventually I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do with this. But... We're disgorging it slowly but surely.
Only a yeast plug that's like 2.5 inches, so it's just, you know, it's fine.
I'll show you a video later because it doesn't just like pop out. It takes like, it slowly comes out. Yeah, it's wild. And then it doesn't really work that well, so you're still yeast in there. You can't get it all out. Yeah. It's not a perfect disgorge when you're making when you're riddling it, you know, we don't have proper riddling racks. We didn't add like riddling adjunctives and additives, and there's a bidule that you can put in the bottle that helps you get all the yeast out. And then obviously I was like, oh, this is almost done fermenting, and I put it all in the bottle. So some have a giant 3-inch long yeast plug, and the others like barely have any. So it's all over the place, but it's fun, and it somehow with not adding anything to it, like it's pretty good.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. 2 years on yeast contact and just very light brioche, but nothing crazy. Yeah, that's kind of part of the cellars that we wanted to kind of like introduce. So slowly but surely, we're just seeing what works. We have a really fantastic noble grape cider that I wish we made more of.
Oh man, it's so good. It's we'll have to give them a taste of that too. Did we put? No, it's downstairs. We didn't put it on the draft up here.
No.
But that will release soon. So all the muscadines in my parents' yard is the noble. It's called like a noble muscadine, and we picked it all and we froze it, and we're like, we're gonna do something with this. And it was Eric's idea. Eric number two, I guess. It's like, oh, we should do the muscadine cider. Like, oh, I don't know about that. Like, da da da. And we picked it all, and then my dad's freezer went out, so I was like, well, today's the day we're pressing the like muscadines. And so I pressed it one day, and then like, it did it, and it was just awesome. And I was like, next year, just all the way.
So, oh, yeah, get ready.
So good.
Get ready.
It's like a cider with just the aroma and a little bit of sweetness from the muscadines.
Oh,
and
cool.
Sounds awesome.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's chuggable.
So maybe let's back up just a minute and remind folks what a Paquette is.
Yeah, so essentially we take the spent skins from either a rosé or a white wine pressing, and we rehydrate that with our water. We'll sometimes add some sugar or a little bit of honey to bring up the ABV to just over 7 for a little bit more stability. And then we've been messing around a little bit more with kind of skin contact to see what that does. For our approach with these two Paquettes, we wanted something very clean and fresh. So we wanted to, you know, just have a really good expression of each of the varietals, Traminet and Chamberson. But yeah, sky's the limit. Honestly, it was Plebe who turned me on to the idea. And after talking about their insane process of, yes, there's 11 great varieties make this one Paquette, so nobody really knows what it is. You keep going around and asking your friends, like, do you like Paquette? What would you do? And then we kind of found our own method. But yeah, it's unfortunate that it's hard to label with TTV, but you know, slowly but surely it's coming out there.
I think more people do it. Mm-hmm. And I must say, we tried both of them earlier. So the Traminette is called Skinny Dip.
Yes, indeed.
And the Chamberson one is Great Crush. Right?
Yes, indeed.
And they were both like super flavorful, but nice and light and refreshing, and just perfect for summer or, you know, warm day, which we have plenty of those in North Carolina.
Yeah, right? And you said clean. I mean, they were definitely clean.
Yeah,
they were
crisp.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to keep them clean because they're low ABV.
Right.
You know, the acid, the pH is higher. The pH is higher and the acid is lower. So keeping them not too funky, but like some people want funky. So it's a weird balance of it all.
Yeah.
They're like seemingly easy, but also seemingly like difficult.
We hit so many like impasses where like, do we go this way or this way? I don't know. Like, what have other people done? Well, they haven't yet. Okay, so we'll try this way. Oh yeah, for sure. But it's fun. Like, we like to just joke around and have a good old time with it. And at the end of the day, we're just trying to make things that we want to drink and share. So this was nice to envision, you know, just very quaffable beverage that you don't have to like put into a fancy wine glass and consume. You're just cracking the can, having it nice and chilled, and having a good old time with it.
Excellent.
So we didn't really talk about the wines yet.
Yeah. Let's go back to that.
Yeah.
The wines. All right.
The things with corks.
You know, corks. So.
Cork talk.
What's cool about the wines? All right, everything's cool about the wines. I am excited because I've been able to express our vineyard and my style of winemaking. I think that's coming out more and more. I haven't sprayed herbicides 2 years now, and I've only sprayed organic for a year now. And so I also, sometimes I try to get away from even adding sulfites in the beginning of my process. And we're pitching yeast, but Eric had a guy that came out, and we're trying to find our own yeast strains out in the vineyard. Next year, I think not a new fad, but some really cool science on non-sac yeast. So the non-traditional yeast you would use, they can only really ferment to about 3 or 4%. The idea is instead of adding sulfites at the beginning, you can use these non-saccharomyces yeast, and they will start the process quicker, and it allows you to not have to add sulfites in the beginning. I try to make lower sulfite wines. I try to keep oxygen away and not just use sulfites as like a backbone. Not saying there's anything wrong with it, you know, and there's not anything wrong with any, you know, it's, this is like, I kind of want to make a natural wine, as natural as I can. Maybe I would like to say low intervention winemaking.
Right, sure.
Like for all the wines last year, you know, we don't chaptalize the sugar at all. We don't add any sugar back. Well, some of our stuff we definitely had sugar back, but we try not to with our like traditional wine. So the wine, the other, we have like our fun projects, and we have like, hey, here's a traditional wine. Try not to do much of it. And I try to make it taste like from our place without adding a whole bunch of stuff to it. So I do as my best as I can to try to do that. So that's pretty exciting to me that I've been learning a lot more to do that, because it's actually not that easy. Like, there's a reason all of these products and stuff exist. Like, you're trying to also make as good as wine as you can.
Oh, sure.
So that's really important. But, you know, just my ideas of like farming and the way I want to make my wine, I want to try to make it like that. And sometimes it doesn't always work out. And sometimes it's not the right way. Sometimes it's not going to make the best wine. But you always have those other resources like in your back pocket if you have to do that. But it's so challenging in North Carolina to do exactly what I want to do. So sometimes it doesn't always work out. Sometimes you pick your grapes and they will make an 8% wine. Like now, like we need it to get above 11-12% because it just won't be stable. So, you know, we have to use sound winemaking practices, you know, for sure. But in the really, really good years, it's cool to like not have to add a lot and be like, hey, this is like exactly like the grape tastes like. It's like what we wanted to do. So that's pretty exciting.
So what year do you think was the best vintage that you've seen here so far?
You know, here, oh man, 2017 was a really good year, I think, for everybody in North Carolina. It's weird because every variety has a different year. Right. It's not, you know, like one year, if it's extra rainy, like Norton, for instance, could be better, you know, and it's like,
that's why you plant these.
Yeah. So yeah, that's why we have so many different ones. Right. Certain years like Cab Franc was amazing. And then Treminet can be amazing one year. And other years it's really hot. And other years it's like perfect in September. And other years like the hurricane comes, you have to pick it early. And, so I couldn't say I have like the best year, but it's more about making the best decisions for that year. Like, we've been doing a lot of like sparkling wines and, you know, hey, if like your grapes are really, really sound and there's a hurricane coming and they're at 10.5-11%, you know, making a sparkling wine could be like the right choice instead of trying to let them hang for 2 or 3 more weeks and get some rots. You know, you can just like get them off. You can make a beautiful sparkling wine. So we're really excited about making more sparkling wines this year. So.
Yeah, sparkling it seems to be growing in the state. Like the number of people doing it, which is really cool that that's the case. And some of it should be because of what you just mentioned. The weather could help impact that. Because, you know, so yeah, you got sometimes you do have to pick early, and so why not then?
And right. Most people like sparkling, so
yeah.
I mean, it's such a perfect. I mean, it's
hot. It does with everything, and it's hot.
Yeah, people love the cold sparkling beverage, and I love champagne, sparkling wine. You know, so
it's funny when we get to the point where it's like, should we sparkle this? And sometimes we do make the decision, as we were talking about before, with the Chardonnay, where I was like, this dish is just so good still, like. Understand like to incorporate a little bit of bubbles and let it go through a different secondary process, it'll change it. But it seems, especially now with the consumer trends and with our taps, you know, people prefer a Traminette that's a little bit bubbly, and who doesn't like bubbles?
Very true. So we're actually in a pretty good spot to take a quick little break. But when we come back, you mentioned taps, you mentioned kegs. So we're going to talk a little bit about some of the alternative methods that you have for keeping and preserving and selling your wines. So, and then we'll see where the conversation takes us. It's time again for Wine Class with the Wine Mouths. Jesse and Jessica, welcome back.
Thanks.
So I think we're in the 1800s, is that right?
No, we finished those.
Oh gosh, I must have been asleep then. So we're going to be in the 1900s.
We're going to be that boring.
No, never.
It's going to take us a while to get to the 1900s,
yeah.
Though.
So. Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot recorded, so a lot more information to share.
Yes. And we've also covered a lot of time, so it's easy to mix up.
Ooh. Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, let's dive in.
All right, so let's set the stage since, you know, the 1800s were so long ago. And we've moved on to the 1900s, right? So the early 1900s were a time of continued colonization, lots of technological advances. You know, in the early 1900s, we all know, of course, about the Wright brothers' flight here in North Carolina. Also, the Model T was released and took over as the first affordable car and transportation. But also in the early 1900s, we have like really conservative lifestyles and monarchies and things that are happening. Mm. So
I can see where this is going.
The temperance
and war. I mean, war has been universal throughout history, but it really takes the stage here in the 1900s. So it's actually the culmination of European militarism and some assassinations and important events that eventually leads us to, of course, World War I, which we know lasted from 1914 to 1918. And the end of this war, which we're going to dig into this time period a little bit, but the end of this war actually triggered the abdication of many monarchies and the collapse of many modern empires. Russia, Georgia, Ottoman Turkey, and Austria-Hungary all fell at the end of World War I. So it's a time of a lot of change. Yeah. Mm.
So let's dive in and go through some stories. So we're going to start in France. We're going to be in France a lot.
Oh, God.
But specifically France in the time of World War I. So we're going to be in the city of Reims in northern France. And so this city had seen a lot of battles already, right? France was a hotspot for war to this time. So you would think maybe they would have had a plan to defend the city. They didn't. But it was founded by the Gauls during the Roman Empire, so old city. And the cathedral here is where the kings of France were crowned. So it's a very important place. But here we have World War I. The German troops are starting to take to the north in 1914. So this city starts to get worried, specifically because they're worried about their upcoming vintage, which was looking really good. But here we have the Germans sweeping in on September 3rd.
Ooh.
And by September 6th, they'd gone round and over the mountain of Reims to reach Epernay. So this is kind of like the gateway to Paris. So the Germans thought they'd be there by October. So they were trying to get to Paris. But they never got to Paris in World War I. We'll have to save that one for the sequel.
AKA World War II.
So in the first Battle of the Marne, they were squeezed back out, and they had some reinforcements for Paris. They were squeezed out, so they were ejected from Reims on September 13th. So if you remember, they just got there September 3rd, so they were not there long.
No, 10 days.
Would you say they got reamed?
And I should have said this earlier, but I didn't, but this city is where it's in the Champagne region. This is the vintage they were wanting. So they leave on September 13th. So it's looking like Champagne would be okay after all. They'd be free. They had a very brief occupation. It was fine. But looks can be deceiving. Because even though they left Reims and the Germans were gone, they didn't move far. So they still were dug in the slopes of the mountain of Reims. And this is actually where Champagne's Pinot Noir was grown. So they weren't in the city anymore, but they were still like on the outskirts where the vineyards were. The front line ran through some of the best vineyards. trenches went through the slopes, so all the shells are going through the vines. Yet, harvest was brought in. So this is harvest time, right? But sadly, it came at a cost. So no one is quite sure how many adults died in the harvest, since it was hard to tally because men were being killed on all sides of the war, and if you're a vintner or not, or vineyard person. But they do know that 20 children died in the vineyards bringing in the 1914 harvest. And then same in 1915, still going on. Another great vintage, but still harvested under the rage of the war in Germany. So the 1914 and 1915 vintages are known as the blood vintages. And so they say the blood of France runs through them. And very occasionally an old bottle is brought out and drunk in a solemn mood of respect. Because these are good but sad wines, right? So not only did harvesting the grapes be this heroic feat, but so was even making the wine. The Germans began bombarding Rheims on September 14th, only a day after they had been forced to retreat. They continued the bombardment for 1,051 days.
Wow.
The cathedral we talked about earlier was gutted, and not one single home escaped. The entire population, almost the entire population, had been evacuated. By the end of the war, only 100 civilians out of a pre-war population of 120,000 were left.
Wow.
So in the first couple of years of the war, the citizens kind of went underground. They had all the cellars. They had created this elaborate system underground. So to start off, they went underground, but for 1,051 days, that would have been difficult. So they evacuated. They say, though, that underground, not one single bottle of champagne was broken by the shelling in the war.
Well, that's good news.
Yeah.
Bon nouvel.
Early on, when they were still using this before they had evacuated, this cave system was said to hold 50,000 soldiers. So French soldiers were using it to use an area. So...
wow.
That's the story from World War One. Sad, but the wine survived.
Yeah.
So the things we do for our wine.
Yeah. And with trench warfare, they probably didn't move much at all in that time period.
Well, trudging through vines, too, is difficult. I mean, that would not be the way I would choose to go, but I'm not a good strategist. And
No.
Wasn't my call.
Yeah.
Well, my segue was not is not very good, but I'm going to say it anyways. And now we're going to talk about something even sadder.
This is a sad episode.
Prohibition.
Which you're still paying for.
Yeah.
In certain ways.
So Prohibition, a.k.a. the 18th Amendment, it was known as the Volstead Act, and it established a national prohibition in the United States and outlawed the manufacture and sale of alcoholic beverages from January 16th, 1920 until December 5th, 1933. So wine was not the main target of prohibition, but the whole temperance movement was more concerned with whiskey and other liquors, but wine kind of got caught up in the mess here. But clearly, from our modern standpoint, we know how terrible this so-called noble experiment turned out. It was just not good. And today, we still are dealing with some of these crazy state laws because of prohibition. But we're going to talk about some of the more fun side effects of prohibition and maybe some glimmers of hope, you know, where you could still sit at home and enjoy a glass of wine, even if that quality is debatable. So while we think prohibition is crazy, it actually was in the works almost from the start of modern history. So throughout history, there have been many movements for temperance, not even just in the United States, but in other New World countries like New Zealand, Australia. There were historically movements for temperance here. In the United States, the temperance movement was led by Protestants and Puritans. Really, even going back to many of the founding fathers were Puritan. So since ye old colonial times. This movement gained ground in the 19th century, and their goal was fixing everything they saw that was wrong is stemming from alcohol. So alcoholism, I think they had that one right, but some of these other things, family violence, saloon-based political corruption, they really felt alcohol was just the root of all evil in America. So by the time of Prohibition, this anti-alcohol movement had been growing for more than 100 years. Many states and communities had passed their own dry laws during this time, but at this point, enforcement of these laws became a topic of debate. Now, quick side note here to explain that women tended to support Prohibition. And because of that, or maybe as a side effect of that, they go hand in hand, women's rights became entrenched with other issues of the day, intemperance. So these things went hand in hand, women's suffrage, and really these temperance movements supported women's suffrage, and then they got support hand in hand, so it kind of was a symbiotic relationship.
Makes you wonder where you would have been in that situation.
I might have gone for it.
We didn't live then.
Yeah. So women, I'm not going to talk in great strides here, but women tended to support this, and they went hand in hand with women's suffrage. So, like, thank you for the right to vote, but, you know, could go for some wine. But the first state to go dry was Maine in 1851. And by 1909, Prohibition had reached North Carolina. Now, we talked about World War I, and by the time that started in 1914, 33 states were dry.
So the real start of Prohibition was way earlier than...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, than when it was codified and legalized and ratified. During World War I, there was patriotic sentiment to preserve foodstuffs for the war effort rather than use them for alcohol production. And this really went hand in hand with the temperance movement that was already in effect and led to the majority support for the 18th Amendment, which came about in January 1920. Now, you might think that winemaking would go down during this time, but actually, turns out winemaking increased by 50% during this time. What? Mm. Oh, why? Great question. Thanks for asking. So professional winemaking dwindled, but winemaking at home and by bootleggers increased.
Mm.
Yeah. So it turns out there was a loophole. Leave it to a wine drinker to figure out. But there was a loophole that allowed a person to manufacture, quote, non-intoxicating cider and fruit juices exclusively for use in his home. No, his home, not her home. Mm. Oh, that hurts. But this became a gray area, and you could crush 200 gallons of grape juice a year for your family.
Huh.
Yeah.
And if you just happen to let it set there.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Oops, I forgot. But vineyards boomed, and grape prices actually went from $10 to $20 a ton prior to Prohibition to $100 to $150 a ton.
Wow.
Yeah. So things were looking good. But let's think about which grapes were doing well, right? So Riesling and Pinot Noir, for instance, they would not sell well. So people were shipping these across the country back to the East Coast to use. So Riesling and Pinot Noir wouldn't sell well because they're really fragile and they have thin skins. You can't really put those in a boxcar and ship them across the country and expect anything good to show up back east. But there were some thicker skinned varieties like Alicante Bousquet, if you've heard of that one. But that was actually the most popular. It's a Tonturier grape, meaning its juice is also colored. So it could withstand that journey back on the railroads and be used for, quote, home winemaking. So these East Coast home winemakers could stretch out their production by adding water and sugar and getting more wine per pound of fruit. So they were ripping out like Mission grapes and things like that and putting in more of these at that time.
Hmm.
So within a couple years, more homemade wine was being produced annually than all the commercial wineries had produced before the ban.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And another caveat to that increase in winemaking at this time is that wine was still legal for religious use. So at this time, Catholic congregations soared and Jewish synagogues sprang up. And you could get registered as a rabbi just by presenting a list of your congregation.
Or your neighborhood. Yeah. Like, hey, friends.
Yeah. I need you to sign this petition. Also, doctors could and would prescribe liquor for certain ailments. There was a guy named Paul Mason who had a medicinal champagne, and this boomed.
Oh.
Yeah. Virginia Dare, America's best-known wine before Prohibition, became Virginia Dare Wine Tonic and still did well. So. Also, wine bricks and kegs of juice were sold with a yeast pill attached. But there was a disclaimer, quote, if you use this, it will turn into wine, which would be illegal. So absolving them of any responsibility here.
They warn everyone.
Yeah. Warning, may become wine. Vine Glow Concentrate offered home delivery, and the delivery man would actually start the fermentation off and return 60 days later with empty bottles and your next keg of juice. So
you didn't even have to make your own homemade wine.
Yeah. That's amazing. Like, talk about a small business with some get up and go. But we know eventually we saw the error of our ways, and Prohibition ended with the 21st Amendment, which repealed Prohibition. But it transferred authority to individual states, and then many states relegated this to the county level. So, like, here in North Carolina, we still have dry counties. Which we are surrounded by. And at the end of Prohibition in 1933, there was a lot of anticipation that with its end would come a rapid resurgence of the wine industry. But this was not the case, actually. There were several factors that prevented this. So one was that during their long closure, wineries had just fallen into disrepair. Like, 13 years was too long just to let it set and forget. And there were a few skilled winemakers available. Also, Prohibition ended during the middle of the Great Depression, so there was little demand and few resources available for rebuilding. And then people's tastes had changed during this time. People got used to their poor quality homemade wine that was often sweetened or fortified with distilled alcohol to cover up flaws, and they just weren't really going for it. That's Prohibition.
In a nutshell.
Yeah.
We're going to hop back to France. I'm just going to live in France this episode. But specifically this time, we're going to go to Bordeaux. So at this time, early 1900s, the standard practice was for the wine houses or chateaus to send most of their barrels of wine that had just finished fermenting to a merchant that would then blend, bottle, distribute the wine. They did keep some from themselves that they cared for, nurtured, and bottled by hand. But the wine that was getting out to the masses was done by the merchants. Well, they didn't know what was happening, right? Like, there was no rules. There was nothing. It's just they're sending good wine out, and who knew what was getting in the bottle. Well, we have a man, Philippe de Rothschild, who took over his family property. Chateau Mouton. Rothschild. So this was in 1922 that he took this over. He was 20 years old. So can you imagine getting this whole chateau and wine industry to yourself as a 20-year-old?
I don't know. People were more mature back then.
True. True. But he decided he wanted to change things. He already came in and was like, no. So these merchants were improving the wine. You didn't see my air quotes, but there were air quotes around the improving. By adding other varietals to improve the color, they would add in cheaper products to make the good products last longer and go further. There's even tales about adding some elderberry or blackberry juice to brighten it up a little bit. The merchant's goal is to sell more wine, right? De Rothschild decided that the wine of Mouton must be made from then on, it must be bottled at the property, the chateau. So that the ones who prepared it were the ones who cared about it the most, and that's what people would be drinking is what he knew he had made. So now this seems like, well, duh. But at the time, this was crazy. He persuaded the other four top estates in Bordeaux to join him in doing the same thing. And the other four were also the other first growths of the 1855 classification. So he's getting all the top dogs on board with now bottling at the Chateau, and only offering the wine for sale that was bottled at the Chateau. So this all sounds great, right? Like, we're making strides forward. But it actually threw the Bordeaux trade into turmoil, because then everybody started questioning all Bordeaux wine. And so everything got questioned, and it took until 1971 for it to be mandatory for all the classified growths to bottle their wine at the Chateau themselves. So this is 1924, was when Philippe de Rothschild had his first Chateau bottled wine, but then it took until 1971 for it to be like the thing you were supposed to do.
Wow.
Crazy. But he was a trendsetter.
Yeah. All right, well, now we're going to stay on the continent, but we're moving to Portugal. And specifically, the home of port in the Douro Valley in Portugal. The time is 1931. The place is Quinta do Naval, a beautiful, steeply terraced property high above the river valley. All right, so you can just picture it, right? Here, there are some vines, 6 acres to be exact, that were never killed by phylloxera. Yeah, this tiny patch did have to be replanted and was replanted with Tariga Nacional vines in 1925. And the vines were on their own rootstocks, ungrafted. They've given about half the crop on the rest of the state, but the crop here is like these tiny, super sweet, lovely grapes. And all right, so right, it's 1931. These vines are only about 6 years old, if we can do math. But we have our crop to make port. Now, in 1931, the Great Depression is raging. It's got the world in its grips, right? It's not just the United States. It's worldwide at this point. Business is not so good for port. And people decided that whatever money they had was certainly not going to port. But whispers start going around about how good this vintage was. But everybody turned their backs on it, not wanting to take a chance to ship it. There was one guy, a single English merchant, who took the risk. His name was Butler, and he thought that this was the greatest vintage ever made. And he bought all of it.
Wow.
Every single.
Yeah. Yes. And probably didn't make any money and had to sell it for very cheap, but he believed in it.
Yeah. He took a chance. And just had a lot of
money. I know. You can look it up now and see 1931 bottles of this port for sale. Granted, they're not cheap anymore.
So the beginning of the 1900s had a lot. We've got war. We've got prohibition. Got it all.
Yeah. And we only made it to 1931.
Wow.
Yeah, just the highlights. But, you know, so we can end with some food pairings. So we talked about champagne, and we talk about this one a lot. So we're trying to like dig deep about what different food pairings we might try here. And we've talked about the high-low pairings with just some, you know, like snack foods almost. Yeah. But pommes frites with some fancy little French fries with truffle oil or just like a salt and pepper or a rosemary garlic situation could be really
all
good. Yeah.
Specifically, sitting outside at a restaurant with your glass of champagne and your appetizer, pommes frites, while you're waiting on the rest of your meal.
Yeah. So, our big takeaway from Prohibition was just the growth and renaissance of basement wine and just these at-home winemakers. So, how would you make the most of subpar wine? And so, some of the ideas we bandied about here are, you could cook with it. Yeah. Always an option here. Something we have heard about and tried before is if you have a not so great wine, you can kind of bulk it up and do your own blending at home with some port or something fortified to just give a little extra kick in the pants.
Go back like the olden days, merchants and ads.
Making your own blends.
Yeah. Elderberry.
Distilled alcohol.
But a wine mouth favorite is just to turn it into sangria and make it the backbone of a fruity cocktail situation.
We do like turning it into vinegar too. We've done that before, and it just that's good for dressings.
Yeah. There you go. We also talked about Bordeaux because Rothschild, remember that guy? Its location is Left Bank. So that red blend is going to be predominantly Cabernet Sauvignon. So with that, you know, grilled beef, something with mushrooms, little roasted baby lambs.
Aww.
Yeah. Or maybe just lamb. Not specifically not the baby dolls. Yeah. Longtime listeners will understand that reference. And then finally, port, which I truly struggle to pair with in real life because I don't often reach for a bottle of port to open. But with this, you could do some different cheeses, even like a pork slider. You know, we're in barbecue country, but maybe something like that might stand against the port.
Hmm.
If you're going to go the dessert route, then you'd want to be careful about hydrating it, but it could certainly stand against a fruit pie of some sort, perhaps, and then maybe chocolate brownies, but like, got to be the right kind. Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. Or maybe just by itself. But yeah, anything else to add? I don't know. I'm getting hungry, as always. Where are our pommes frites?
I know. They're waiting for us on the bistro. Well, excellent. Well, this has been very enlightening. We're very happy to be in the 1900s, and we're looking forward to the next one.
Thank you.
You can find out more information about the Wine Mouths by going to their website, winemouths.com, or on Facebook and Instagram at Wine Mouths. That's WineMouths. And now, back to the show.
All right, so we're back with Eric and Eric. So let's go ahead and talk a little bit about where we left off. We had mentioned the tap system. We mentioned kegs. And before, before we started recording, you mentioned how using kegs is kind of a cool, innovative thing that you're doing, and it's a different approach to it. So let's talk a little bit about some of that.
Yeah. Every winery that I've worked at, we've used kegs, and it's something that I think the barrier to entry is just a little bit of knowledge, but then you can go to your local brewery and talk to the brewer about kegs, and they're just going to tell you everything. What we found that works real well in our cellar is being able to maintain and move the wine in a certain direction that we want. So if we're low on a tank and we have enough kegs, especially if we need to top barrels, we're able to put the wine in kegs and make sure it's stable. So essentially we'll purge with CO2 about 3 times, so it's completely free of oxygen. And then literally with any pump that you have in the winery, you can pump into the keg or even gravity fill if the wine is high enough. What we found works well for us is small scale kind of carbonation as well. So we are able to take a wine that we want to see if it's going to be good sparkling, and we'll do some measurements, we'll see the pH, if we have any residual sugar, and we'll tune it to certain carbonation levels to understand where that's going to go. That could only get us to kind of right around beer level, anywhere between Vino Verde-esque kind of light spritz to kind of like a higher carbonation, like a Saison in a beer style. But what we found is there's so many different avenues that we can do with it. We had one mysterious mead keg that we made into a pet net, and it was literally right at almost terminal, around 1.003 specific gravity. You just open the valve, dump it straight into the keg, close it, forget about it. It was in the corner of our cellar for 9 months, and then Eric is like, "Hey man, I need this keg." And I was like, "All right, I'll figure it out." So it was funny, just threw it in the fridge, all that yeast kind of dropped out, and within 9 months, we were able to get that nice toasty brioche character and make a natural mead with no sulfites. It was pitched with a commercial yeast, Vin-13, but we were able to counter pressure fill it into bottles. So we were able to take the approach of experimentation at small batch with kegs. And then commercial-wise, we do notice, especially out in the wholesale market, a lot of breweries are like, "Hey, I'll buy a keg off of you." And you're like, "So you want to buy 5 gallons from me?" and it might be this price. And they're like, awesome. Yeah, for sure. Wow. It makes sense for us personally, just because we don't have to worry about the packaging, the labels, and everything like that. We could just go straight into kegs. It's an easy day. And then with their tap system, pushing CO2 or nitrogen, just depending on what their intention is with the wine, that's the only other consideration that we'll have. Push with nitrogen, it's going to maintain still. If you push with CO2 over time, mm-hmm. it will actually carbonate to that level that it's being pushed at. But then, hey, you made your own sparkling wine. So there's a few different options. Argon is a really good noble gas that you can also use as well to push out of. But as what we kind of see here, we can save on bottling 20 cases and throw them into half barrels and sixtals, and that'll be completely served here on tap, fresh as it can be, and then you have your to-go package as a cork and bottle. But yeah, it's one conversation that we've been having, is trying to understand how much will the wine change over time. But from our trials and just ease of use, we can clean the kegs in-house, we can fill them. And especially if you have a local brewery and you have 20 kegs, they'll just let you come wash them real quick, and it works out pretty well. But we do kind of see this as something more of a on-premise tap situation, and hopefully with the possibility of wholesale and with bars and different other retailers, they're more inclined to buy a keg just because the cost per ounce makes so much more sense. And we're saving at least 30% just due to the packaging reduction that we're doing.
It's a little bit more sustainable too than just a glass bottle.
I think we're still behind a few. Hopefully within the next 5 years, you're going to start seeing a lot more wine bars with kegs. But I think we also need to be open as an industry and talk about it. I was very apprehensive getting into it, and then now we can clean them pretty easy.
Yeah, I definitely agree with all that's great, and it's, you just have to be slightly more careful when you put it in there or like a can. You get more reduction, and that's where kind of like this lower sulfite sort of level, like you might need to do that in a keg. If you add like a bunch of sulfites, like it doesn't breathe, it's not going to ever go away. So it's something to think about, and that's why I've been kind of going down the path, like, oh, can I use different products for a lower sulfite? If I add less in the beginning, it's going to contribute less overall. Plus, if I can create the stable product in a keg, not only is it like obviously more economical and all that stuff, but when we're opening those bottles of wine, like, I have to check the date. When did I open this? So if, like, even some of our reds, if you open it 3 days ago, it's like not quite the same, and you give it to a brewery and they're closed Monday and Tuesday, and they open one Sunday, and now it's like Thursday, and that's just like an entire bottle like gone, wasted, and for a small business, like, just like throwing out money, and then they're like, we're just gonna give, and then they open up and try my wine, and it's just like, this isn't that great, it was like, well, it's open like 4 or 5 days, like, yeah. So now out of a keg, it's, I hate to compare it to like a giant box of wine, but but it's in like a nice vessel, and all these breweries, they all have the setup and ease to just use them. So it's pretty awesome, and it's super fast to like serve it out of the tap, and it's not opening that bottle and recycling that glass. That's so huge.
And it's 66 glasses per keg, and that's a 5 gallon keg. You just save so much there. Yeah, I wonder what the future holds and if other wineries are interested in that. I think we just need to honestly have a good conversation between, this is how you would approach kegging down a red wine versus a white wine, a rosé. But I do think, in terms of reduction and trying to do our part, kegs would be
future. And it's a good entry point to the local brewery too, right, or to the bars, because they already have the equipment to do that. They're not having to find shelf space for bottles, they're not having to deal with the glass. It's just like easy in, easy out. So
I think people are probably more inclined to try a wine that's on tap. It's like, you can just have like a quick sip. It's not this whole open the bottle and like, you didn't like it. And so it's like, if it's on tap and it's on your tap menu, people are even more like, when you go to like a bottle shop and your wine's like far off in like the dark corner and they can't try it, they're gonna be a lot less inclined to buy it, especially. Slowly North Carolina has really been making a really good name, and we're making so we're making such really good wine in North Carolina now, but maybe it's not always been the case, but you know, more and more people are learning about it. It's definitely intimidating to buy like a bottle from here on the shelf. You have no idea what it's about.
So maybe let's switch gears a little bit and talk about when folks come to visit Fireclay, what can they expect to see and do and that sort of thing when they come?
Let's see. So the winery is pretty much in the middle of the vineyard. So if you sit on the deck, you come outside, there's the vines, you drive down the vines, they're all there. That's cool to see. I think it's cool to see as a person that loves to work in the vineyard. Like, yeah. I mean, it's all about the vineyard in my eyes. We have tastings, we have different meads, different sparkling products on tap. We have, I think we have 7-8 different kinds of wines. We have 3 different kinds of meads on tap right now.
We have 3 different kinds of meads, a couple of piquettes, and then any cellar experiment that we have, we'll usually kind of creep up here and see what people are kind of feeling and get some engagement with that.
We do some food trucks, we have some light music. Sort of like a typical winery, I guess. It's pretty, it's like very small family run winery. So it's, you know, my mom's probably working the bar. So, you know, it's almost like our second home. So it's like our home. So when you come here, you know, treat us like family, we'll treat you like family. You know, it's like, we love wine. We love sharing wine. So we want people who love to like try different wines. And some people like to go out on picnic tables and hang out all afternoon, or some people want to try wine, and yeah, that's...
Yeah, it's a very homey feeling. I mean, you're literally meeting the owners and the vineyards and the winemakers. I'm one of 2 paid employees here. And then, you know, the family is something that, that changed my perspective of what a vineyard can be in a winery, was just you felt at home. First time I met Andre, Eric's dad, we sat down for 2 hours just talking wine, getting to know each other, and it was just a calm, casual Thursday evening, kind of like this, or Friday. And then from here, you kind of just invite more. It's more of that intentional little gem in Chatham County. I mean, we are definitely boutique, under 1,000 cases a year, and maybe making like 500 gallons of mead, being hopeful. But with that really comes, you know, sharing. Everyone eventually gets to know each other. Just kind of any Cheers bar is more of an open vineyard and a little home here in Chatham County.
Very cool. Now, you mentioned you love wine. And one of the things that we talked about on the break was your favorite wines. But you said yours is going to be different, yours is going to be different. So what's been your favorite wine?
Let's see. I mean, this could go all over the place. My favorite wine. There's obviously been so. I'm gonna stick with North Carolina wine, because, you know, this is North Carolina wine. So, man, the Albarino from Sanctuary is still such a good wine to me. There's been, that's a really favorite one.
What about of your own?
Of my own. Okay, you wanna go with my own?
Gotta toot your own horn. Yeah.
I would say the Chardonnay in the tank that we have is probably one of my favorites. It's such a mood-dependent thing. That's a problem.
Yeah.
The Fireside, the Cab Franc, and that one, that's my go-to red for sure. We always joke because you love Chamberson. And I'm such a Chamberson hater. But I hate Chamberson all the way until it's like aged really well in the bottle. I'm like, all right, this is actually like pretty good now. And when you try it out of tank, I'm just like, all right, like, I like some Chamberson. But sometimes Chamberson is just, like, so Chamberson-y to me. It's like, but some people love Chamberson. So that's, like, but sometimes I'm in the mood for it. It's
in a blue moon.
I think the Chardonnay in the tank is my favorite wine. When we first were fermenting it, it smelled like bananas. It was wild.
It was literally bananas.
It was just so fresh bananas and... That's one of the wines I was trying to do, like, as low minimal sulfites as possible. And I, like, kind of took a risk. Like, what can we do? Like, what do we do? What happens if we don't add sulfites at the beginning? Not that any of that's bad. It's just sort of, what can I do to do that? Can I put it in kegs? I want to make sure there's no reduction issues. Like, I was practicing a lot for some of the canning products, because you can't have too many sulfites in the can, especially with, for some reason, with wine and high sulfites in the can and the non-ability to breathe creates a reduction environment. So it's kind of like, oh, I'm going to try to practice on all my wines, like, let's see where we can go. I also want to make sparkling wines, so you want to keep your SO2 levels down for that as well. So it's like, well, I got to make sure this yeast can re-ferment a wine that's already 11%. So you got to be careful. So it's just trying to use better winemaking techniques to create a wine that I have more opportunities to do with 5 months down the road. So that was, but yeah, Chardonnay was my favorite.
Chamberson. I love some Chamberson.
That was hesitation. You didn't hesitate.
Oh no, definitely. coming out here and then like the first harvest that we did together was Chamberson, and it was late harvest and it was the most beautiful berries. The wine that changed my perception of Chamberson was actually Carolina Heritage. Their Chamberson back in like 2015. It was so affordable. It was like $14 off of the shelf, completely organic. I've never tasted Chamberson before and caught that bug. I will say our Traminette is something that like is truly such a beautiful expression. I mean, one best Traminette at NC Fine Wines this year, which was fantastic to hear. I think that really describes our vineyard so well. But yeah, depending on the day, the Chardonnay is fantastic. The Red Bland is great. Just it shows so differently, but you know, next week it will probably still be Chamberson.
The Traminette is super versatile. Like you can make a beautiful sparkling wine, you can make it dry, you can make it off dry. It ages well. I like, you know, started my library wine collection, so I have some 2019.
All right.
And so it's like interesting, and I love how it changes like in the tank too when we first made it.
It smells like Mike's Hard Lemonade, and then out of nowhere you're like, oh, this is Traminette. Oh.
Yeah, it's so wild. And so I just kind of like let stuff happen and like, all right, let's see what this goes and stuff. Different kind of like style of doing things. But yeah, I mean, I like Traminette's fun too, and it grows so well. Every year it's healthy and it's so disease resistant. It grows a little wild. I've managed to wrangle it in a little bit by, this is a growing system called the Smart Dyson, where you kind of grow it up and down as well, because it's not a super upright germ variety. But now I call it the Lazy Dyson. So whatever grows down, I like put down. Whatever goes up, goes up. And usually I cane prune it. So like 20-30% of the shoots go down and some go up. And so it like works out really well. I don't have to like go crazy. You know, it creates a more airy environment. So dries out faster. So yeah, the Lazy Dyson.
The Lazy Dyson. Patented.
Yeah, patented.
So what are you most looking forward to in the future though? Is there something in particular, maybe more sparkling wine or more piquettes or more mead or?
I think we could probably both answer that. It's probably sparkling wine.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Piquettes are cool. I like doing piquettes. We're definitely going to do piquettes every single year. I think all wineries should dabble in them. There's little risk.
Yeah.
Like, it's fine. If you have the tank space, do a piquette for sure. I think everyone should do that. Create this lower alcohol wine and see what happens out of it. I mean, it's not free wine, but it's like second use skins. Like, I'm just composting if I don't use them.
Yeah, so right.
You've already made your wine.
I think, everyone should. I mean, we brought it to the conference, and we're trying to get as many people, like, jazzed about it. Like, try to make a piquette. Like, it's pretty cool. It's like a different product. It's a cheaper product to make, and it's a low alcohol, like, product. And yeah, maybe we'll have to do a talk on some piquettes.
I don't know if we're the experts, but it's
it's
been fun. To bring just a lot of diversity into the tap list has been really fun for me, but it's nice to have matching energy where coming out here, the wine was already established, the vineyard was already established. So then now to push the boundaries a little bit more of like, how can we cross influence from other fermentations and other businesses around us. It's really nice to just have that going. The natural carbonation that happens, whether it's a pet nat or a secondary fermentation like a champagne, has, you know, we we talk about bubbles and we're like, it's just better. It just is. So it's fun how things are kind of going back in time. We can kind of maintain our certain viewpoint with it. But I think what I'm really personally excited about is, other than the sparkling, is just the diversity of kind of what's always coming out. Especially to experiment with these new varieties and see what we can do with some different blends and have a little bit more tools in the toolbox. That's going to be really fun to see what really works well and how those different grapes can add to a certain blend that we just need something to help fix it.
We definitely went wild with sparkling wines this year.
Yeah.
We have little experience with it, and we're like, nope, we just sent it. Yeah. All the rosé went to sparkling, we did Trembinet sparkling. We're doing a sparkling cider, like a traditional method cider.
We just went hard on it this year.
We're just going all the way. Just like everything sparkling. Because we just like sparkle wine, we're like, this is better. Like,
so yeah, you'll probably see us in a couple weeks of just like, why did we do this? Like
the stack of rosé. I'm just like, how am I going to disgorge all this? Like, oh no. But the one thing that really helped us was the encapsulated yeast. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Yeah. So that really, we don't have the space to riddle.
Right.
So that was really like when we were doing all the pet nats and stuff, we're like, there's no way we can get all this yeast out. It just won't clear unless you like really riddle it. And now with the encapsulated yeast, it's like, wow. Yeah. Like we
Thank
can
you.
Actually make sparkling wine now and not have to have a giant facility
right.
and riddle wine and, you know.
Yeah, and you can really piece it together, which is nice. We literally have a styrofoam cooler that we pour a bunch of Everclear and dry ice, and that's our -20 kind of neck freezer. There's definitely fancier things that we hope to get to one day. But, yeah, we were able to find a way that it works. And then now, especially with a little bit of dosage, or, you know, as the expression kind of goes, you know, sometimes it's just best to leave it be. The Chamberson Rosé is tasting really good. Just a hint of a dosage, nothing much to cover up anything. Like it's just fruity, it's Chamberson-y. You may be talking to the wrong guy.
That's, it has a good cherry, strawberry like aroma to it. No, I'm really happy with the rosé, and sometimes I'm not, but like sometimes the Chamberson Rosé just takes a while to age. Seems like it's so Chamberson-y. And then it really turns like beautiful strawberry and it really like ages, and then I'm like, I really like this, and then it's gone. I'm like,
Yeah, the 2020 that's on the list right now, it's kind of in that spot.
Yeah, and you know, I hated on it for like a year, and then like my mom was like, people are really liking this rosé right now. I was like, what? I was like, all right, and I tried it. I was like, how did it get good? Like, what happened? Like finally it, you know, but maybe that's, you know, being, you know, you used to give me a hard time because I like would be so cautious about like oxygen. So a lot of like, you know, some reduction, now I wouldn't say reduction issues, but like it just takes forever for the wines to breathe. And when I like bottle it so carefully and transfer it so carefully, it's like no oxygen ever. Like finally, like years in the bottle, like now it's where I wanted it, you know. But then it's always sold out, so it's just like it never has a chance to get where it was. That's why I did the library wines. It's like the Oak Char. Now there's 1 year was really really good, but there was like one case left, and I was like, no, but now is the time for people to drink it. Not a year ago, like, now it's ready. But you can't do that. You just, you know, you got to have some wines on the menu.
Absolutely.
So tell folks, is there anything else that you want folks to know about Fire Clay Cellars? And then maybe tell folks how to find you both physically and virtually.
Well, they can definitely find us on, we do Facebook and Instagram. You know, it's Fire Clay Cellars. And then we have a website. You can Google us and all that stuff. That's how you can find us. And we're in Chatham County. We're 40 minutes outside the Triangle, maybe. So Greensboro, Durham, Chapel Hill,
Raleigh.
And then when you come out here, there's tons of cool stuff to do in Pittsburgh as well. There's like Starlight Mead. There's a bunch of breweries. Sorry if I'm missing, not naming anybody, but all those places in the plant, there's all kinds of, you know, the DMC there. There's the cider. There's Thirsty Skull. There's
Havoc just came in. There's a lot to jerk around here.
So you can do like a tour. You don't have to just come out here. You know, you can come out here, but like there's other stuff to do around. You can make a tour of it, and you know, and then obviously there's a zoo, the Celebrity Dairy. We sell like local goat cheese here. There's some like hiking and other stuff. And the latest thing I actually found on the website was biking. So there's some really good road biking around here.
Oh, cool.
Right from the winery. More and more people have been doing it. Some people bike from Cary to here one time, which is crazy. But don't do that. I mean, if you want to, you can. It's great. But I mean, there's very little cars. There's good hills. Beautiful farmlands. I think, can't remember, there's another like dairy farm thing over there. They're like a inn or something. And basically, there's like tons of good routes. I even put a Strava and a GPX file on the website.
Okay, so you can
do one little 12-mile route, or there's endless possibilities. I've ridden my bike from here to Pittsburgh and grabbed a beer and came back. So I guess that's my point.
Saxville Haw is only 20 minutes away. So Haw River Farmhouse Ales, Left Big Butchery, the Eddie, Saxville Haw General Store. It's fun that we're so close to everything, but so far away.
Right.
And it's nice, honestly, invite anyone listening to come out and enjoy a glass. You'll probably see Eric working in the vineyard, and I'll be in the air conditioning in the cellar.
There's Union Grove that they're kind of starting, where Maple View Dairy was. And they have all the new, I don't know if you, not to go on like a completely different tangent, but the cool new seedless muscadine varieties are coming out, and those are pretty cool, and they're keep developing them more and more. There's some that are developed in North Carolina by somebody, and also like University of like Arkansas, I think, is developing a bunch of varieties. So that's pretty cool. I haven't tried them, but I'm very excited to try them. I think that's really awesome. Like, I would definitely plant them. It'd be cool if people came here and they could eat some like grapes, like,
Yeah, there's a lot going on in this area and lots to do. And one thing we haven't really mentioned is you're at kind of the bottom end of the Haw River AVA, is that right?
Yeah.
So in Haw River AVA, I think, was the second AVA in North Carolina.
Yeah.
After the Yadkin Valley. So.
There's Grove Winery, but it's hard because they're kind of far away.
They're kind of at the north end.
Oh, yeah. North of Burlington.
You've got to get
some green. So they're pretty far, so we usually kind of mention the Pittsburgh is much more local kind of thing.
For sure. Well, we highly recommend everyone come out and visit. And easy access right off of US 64, kind of between Pittsburgh and Siler City. And so it's a good place to come and visit all around this area, and particularly coming to Barclay.
Yeah, well, we appreciate both of you coming out. And shout out to Arthur. Yeah, where's he at?
I will say this is a full circle moment. I always wanted to talk to you all. So never thought we'd be on a podcast, but
thanks for indulging us and having a conversation. We most appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
That's it for this episode of Cork Talk.
Thanks again to Eric and Eric. As you can see, they have a passion for what they do, and they make it fun for everyone.
If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating and review. It helps others find Cork Talk and lets us know how we can improve.
And don't forget to follow us on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at NC Wine Guys. Until next time, and remember, a cork only talks when it's out of the bottle. Cheers! Cork Talk is a Freeman LLC production.
This episode was made possible in part by a grant from the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council.